This podcast is sponsored by Great White Hot Sauce. Do you like hot sauce? Then you'll love Great White Hot Sauce. It's a small batch handmade hot sauce. It's the sauce that bites. Find it at www.trygreatwhite.com. You won't regret it. Is rock and roll dead? Well, that's the question, isn't it? It's been asked since the 1950s. On this episode, we're going to discuss whether we think rock is dead, it's alive, or is it on life support? Maybe you'll agree, maybe you'll disagree. Listen in and find out.
The KLFB Studio presents Milk Crates and Turntables, a music discussion podcast hosted by Scott McLean with his co-host, Jack Calabrese. Now, let's talk music. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, Amanda, for that wonderful introduction as usual. This is Milk Crates and Turntables, a music discussion podcast, but you already know that because you tuned in. We're streaming live right now over a couple of platforms. This is a live streaming, so for the podcast listeners, what you hear is what is live. No editing, no nothing. We just shoot from the hip, and that's it. So without further ado, let me bring on my co-host, the unbelievable... Nope. The producer always wants me to build him up. I will not build up my co-host. The master of music, Jack Calabrese.
Hey, what's going on, man?
Jackie, yo.
What's happening?
Nothing, buddy. How you doing?
I'm good. Good.
All right. You ready to do a show?
I'm ready to do the show. Let's do the show.
All right.
What do you want to start? What do you want to talk about?
Let's I want to jump right into something. We are not holding back here, buddy. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Hey, you want to hear a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame riff?
What's that? I'm not buying. Okay. Are you done?
Puscati!
Oh, no. No singing on this podcast, buddy, please.
I don't want to violate any copyright laws. I don't want you getting banned.
You're violating more than copyright laws when you sing, buddy. I guess I have something else to... Let's start this off. The Go-Go's gone into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Whoops. As they should.
As they should.
Legends. But,
Yeah. The Rock and Roll Hall of Sham is what I'm calling it. But I have to play this. So podcast listeners, listen up. And here we go.
Hey, Scott. I have something here I need to read you. I was given this script to read to you, okay? So hang on. G here from the Go-Go's. Congrats to you and Jack Calabrese on the Milk Crate and Turntable podcast. I know Jack's been pushing for the Go-Go's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you, not so much, Scott, not so much,
no.
Right? Well, we shall see, brother. Good luck, and fuck you, Daddy. I love you so much, Scott. I can't wait to meet you. Bye-bye, darling.
She hates my guts.
She does not hate your guts.
Who is she kidding?
Does not hate your guts. Although, you know, look, I paid, I don't know, $180 to do that on Cameo. Now that she's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I wonder if her price actually went up.
It should go down.
No, this is it. I am a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. So get this, $190.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm with the Go-Go's, so we'll bump it up $10.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, the debate is over, although you get to watch them when they actually do their induction ceremony.
Who says I'm watching them?
You'll watch.
No, I won't.
You'll watch.
No.
Yes, no. You will. Maybe we'll watch it together. We'll live stream it while we watch it.
No. You know, those concerts that they have, evidently they do concerts before the show itself. Each group has a, and what was it, last year Roxy Music got in, and someone said it was a total fucking bore fest watching Roxy Music on stage, I guess at this point in their life, right?
Yeah, well,
I don't know. Brian Ferry's always been smooth. He's always been smooth.
I mean, I like Roxy Music, but...
I do, too. Yeah, I do, but too.
Not the rockin'est band in the world. Actually, Deb and I, and a handful of people, we actually went down to see Roxy... Not Roxy Music, but Brian Ferry at the Boston Opera House. Fantastic show.
Yeah, Brian Ferry, like I said, he's always been smooth. He's always been a good performer, steady. You know, he knows his limits, and he's good at it. He's kind of that a glam rock guy. You know, he always wore nice suits, always looked good on stage, especially when he went through when he had the patch over his eye. You know, he went through a little, I don't know if that was on purpose. Something might have happened. I don't know. But he was wearing the patch. But he was Brian Ferry. He pulled it off. And it was his sidekick, Brian Eno.
Brian Eno, yeah, he was back in the band way back in the day.
Brian Eno got, you know, he was kind of this underground. I think I'm getting feedback from your computer.
I can turn it down a little bit.
Yeah. Think you're sabotaging me on purpose. So, well, this is live. This is what we get.
How's that?
That's good. So, Brian Eno, you know, he had this reputation when he was with Roxy Music as this mysterious guy. He was the brains behind Roxy Music, supposedly. And then he goes on his own, and everyone expects all this, like, fabulous, great stuff. And it was, I guess, kind of weird music. Like, he never flourished on his own as a performer. There was all this expectation.
I don't think he ever intended to flourish on his own. I think that he did his own thing and recognized that he had a different contribution to make. Although I will tell you, and you may be surprised by this or maybe not, but my wife, Deborah.
The beautiful Deborah.
Who has much cooler taste in music than I do. Brian Eno back in I think it was 74, put out a record called Another Green World. And there are people like Phil Collins is on it. You know, a lot of other, you know, famous musicians are on it. But he is a musician's musician. But she loves that album. I guarantee you that if I were to ask her to give me her top five records, that would be in there. And it's not really an accessible record. It's a little bit left of center. It's kind of odd and whatnot. It's almost like the old Pink Floyd records, like the old Sid Barrett records.
I'm sure that it's a better album than another rock and roll Hall of Fame group, who's Fleetwood Mac, as I hold up the album called Mystery to Me. Has anybody ever heard of this? Has anybody ever heard of the Fleetwood Mac album Mystery to Me?
Most people.
Let me answer that. No. You know why? Because Fleetwood Mac was horrible for 10 years before 1975. This is actually with the, what's his name?
Peter Green?
No, Graham Parsons? No.
No, Bob Welch?
Bob Welch, yeah. This is the Bob Welch edition of Fleetwood Mac. Yeah, with the baboon eating an ice cream cake on the cover, yeah.
They were a different kind of band back then. And you know what? If they had stayed with that lineup, maybe they never would have gotten into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
They wouldn't have. As a matter of fact,
they were a blues band.
Bob Welch he wrote the song Emerald Eyes, not Ebony Eyes, Emerald Eyes. He had a thing for eyes, evidently. And so he takes it off this album that he wrote for Fleetwood Mac, that song. Then he goes on his own. He takes that song with him. It sounds exactly the same.
He might yeah, but he had just, a hit with it on his own.
Emerald Eyes? I know Ebony Eyes he did. This isn't... That's Ebony Eyes. Yeah. That's not this song. That's Ebony yeah. Eyes. This is it. Like I said, Bob Welch had a thing for the colors of eyes.
But wait a minute. Are you saying that Fleetwood Mac does not belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I'm not saying that. I said that.
You shouldn't say that because that would be idiotic.
Our conversation, our argument was that you said they were a great 70s band. And that was in episode like 5 or something.
Yeah, but so, they were a great 70s band. They were an iconic band of the 70s.
Anyways.
Top selling albums of the 70s. You know, Rumors has got to be in the top friggin'
like
five.
I said, if we want to talk about best selling albums, then we'll talk about Fleetwood Mac. So I want to know why the hell the Go-Go's, and don't give me the rundown on they were the first female group to be number one. You know, with the assist of MTV, but and also that you know what I've come across something pretty interesting. I think they had a strategy. They had a strategy to get in, and so did Tina Turner. Not that she needed one, but the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is unpredictable. And I think it started when Rush got in. Rush, right before the vote to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Rush released a documentary.
Good documentary.
It is. And I'm not saying they don't deserve to be, and I think they do, right? I'm not a big prog rock guy, but I like Rush. They're part of our 80s experience, our 80s childhood, right? So, oddly enough, right before the vote for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Go-Go's and Tina Turner both released documentaries. It's like...
I think that the reality of it is that with admission or induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, there's a monetary aspect to it. They get to play off that. They get an uplift in terms of their, you know, downloads and whatnot. But I think the biggest thing is they launch the big tour, you know, and you can be assured of the fact that after the Go-Go's get inducted, that they are going to go on a big tour and they are going to have a resurgence, just like, you know, who that happened to? Hall and Oates. Hall and Oates was, you know, popular in the 80s, kind of cool, kind of cheesy, kind of uncool. They had their time. They kind of went away for a long time. And I'll tell you, like the last time that I saw Hall and Oates, they were playing, you know, Mohegan Sun or Foxwoods, one of those places in a 5,000 seat, you know, place that was not filled.
I saw them at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Hollywood,
Florida. Yeah, but then they get inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and now they're playing, you know, 15,000 seaters.
I remember back when the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame first became a thing, there was plenty of talk saying Hall & Oates will never be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Yeah, there was articles written, oh, Hall & Oates, they don't belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Well, look how diluted and polluted it is now, right? One of our viewers, Renee, she's the best. She just blurts out, Rush sucks.
So, Renee, I'm sorry, my dear. You look like you're a lovely person. I don't really know you.
But listen, the
reality of it is they had a, 40-year career, sold millions of albums, sold out every show that they had. You may not like them, but they didn't suck.
I think it's funny. So if the Go-Go's got in, why hasn't Glen Campbell gotten the Hall of Fame? Glen Campbell, every box gets checked with him. Popularity, records sold, tours, longevity. He's pretty much he was kind of a pop culture icon for a while. Glen Campbell is Glen Campbell, right? He's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Are you sure?
One of the most underrated. I'm positive. He's one of the most underrated guitar players. But
he's great guitar player.
Nashville. He's revered by country, you know, old And now, not today's country. That's pop music. That's not country. We're talking Glen Campbell was around when it was country and western. Now, he wasn't like Merle Haggard, but Glen Campbell was considered pop country in a sense.
You are not going to get an argument from me.
And so
Glen Campbell belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame lets the Go-Go's in with three albums. And I know we can get into the argument of who had three albums.
That is a ridiculous argument. Three albums. So what?
Your ridiculous argument.
What?
You're a ridiculous argument.
The Sex Pistols had one album. Nirvana had three releases, basically.
And?
Robert Johnson recorded, one record back in the day. They're all in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, there's no stipulation in terms of getting into or staying out of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There's nothing that says you have to have five albums or eight albums.
Fleetwood Mac only had three good albums. So, out of 15.
A lot of Fleetwood Mac fans out there.
It's like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inducts Johnny Cash.
How many Glen Campbell albums do you listen to or can you name?
As a matter of fact, I have about three or four in my collection, right?
Which yard sale did you get them at?
Now my collection is a collection of collections.
Sure.
My record collection is partially in your – you contributed to that.
Yes, I did.
You and the wonderful Deb had some doubles because you – that's the sign of true love when you merge your record collection. But kids today wouldn't understand that.
No.
So somebody, I got them from somebody. I'm not sure who. I might have even actually got them at my father's house because my father had a huge collection that I pillaged. But Glen Campbell, not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Dolly Parton, not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Both should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you know why Dolly Parton's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Why?
Because she only works 9 to 5.
Good night, everybody.
Well, what else was I going to say? But see, I can't believe you fell for that one, first of all.
We've hit a new low. Well,
I'm just trying to keep up with you, my friend. Just trying to keep up with you.
So hey, since you mentioned her, wait a minute. For those of you that don't know, the people that actually got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame were Tina Turner, Carole King, the Go Go's, Jay Z, the Foo Fighters, Todd Rundgren, Kraftwerk, Charlie Patton, Gil Scott-Heron, Billy Preston, LL Cool J, Clarence Avant, and Randy Rhoads. Which is an interesting class, and I don't know if there's some.
How does Randy Rhoads get in, but Ozzy doesn't get in on his own?
Well, that's what I mean. There may be some category that's dedicated to like the greatest sidemen. I think with like Chuck Berry, his piano player Johnny Johnson, who by the way was rumored to have written all those songs, he got in. So I think there's a category called. The sideman, whatever it's called, though, the greatest sideman.
The JB's in there. The JB's aren't in there.
They're probably not. I don't know if it's meant to be just one individual or not. I don't know. I'd have to look at it. But Tina Turner. Tina Turner is already in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for what she did with Ike Turner. So then she obviously had a big resurgence and had a huge career in the 80s and maybe your early 90s. I'm not saying that she doesn't belong in there, but I think that the Tina Turner story is the thing that really makes her more compelling. I mean, when was the last time that you put on a Tina Turner record?
I never have.
Yeah. I mean, she's great, great live performer and whatnot, but just kind of an interesting choice. I'll tell you the other thing that is weird, and I guess this is kind of a byproduct of just getting older. I look at Jay-Z, the Foo Fighters, and I I can't believe they're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They seem like they haven't been around long enough to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Obviously, they have. Their first albums were released. I mean, Foo Fighters have been around for 25 years, which is just crazy. But it just seems like there are so many other bands or artists that should be getting in before them.
Again, I've always said Chic. They're not in. They've been nominated 11 times.
Yeah.
Chic gets pigeonholed as a disco band, but they're actually more than that. They were so influential on not only dance music, but funk and hip-hop across the board. Nile Rodgers, one of the most talented bass players, producers that has ever stepped into a studio.
Hugely influential.
But they won't let them in this group. So I lobbied for years for Depeche Mode to finally get in. I always thought that they should be in. They should have been in sooner than they were, right?
Great synth band.
Last year. Yeah, synth band. That's right. And another synth band, and I will scream this from the top of the mountains, the Pet Shop Boys need to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If you're putting in Jay-Z and LL Cool J, when you talk about the Pet Shop Boys, number one.
Why? State your case.
They're the most successful duo in UK music history. They're in the Guinness Book of World Records, right? Which puts them number two behind Hall & Oates as a duo in total record sales, right? In 2016, Billboard magazine named the Pet Shop Boys the number one dance duo group over the last 40 years since the chart's inception in 1976. Okay? This is America talking. I know they're a British band. They came over. Since 84, they've achieved 42 top 30 singles, okay? And they've had a number of number ones. In the 80s, they had 5 top 10 singles. And they're still touring. They're still putting out music. They haven't stopped, right? Neil Tennant's gone on. He's mixed with electronic, with Johnny Marr, and what's his name from New Order, the lead singer.
Peter Hook?
The lead singer. It's his name.
Bass player.
Yeah.
So you might be surprised to hear this, but Deb and I are actually going to see them. I think they're coming this fall.
New Order wanted, they were going to play the Jackie Gleason Theater in Miami, Fillmore East. They wanted $200 a ticket.
Just New Order.
Just New Order. Are you shitting me? I mean, no. I wouldn't. Very few bands I'd pay $200 to see. They're not one of them.
But venturing into a different topic, which is fine. But I mean, concert tickets are ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, the last time that Madonna came around, I think tickets in the first, you know, 5 rows or whatnot, they were literally thousands of dollars.
They start off at like $1,500.
Yeah, thousands of dollars. I remember my father screaming at me, nose to nose, screaming at me because I paid $20 to go see Springsteen. Now, granted, that was back in 1980, but he was like,
because in the 70s, tickets were $7, $8, $9, and $10.
Yeah, but that was it. You know, that was back in the day where you could actually go and see a lot of shows. Now people, you know, they go to a couple. I mean. You know, the reality of it is that, you know, musicians are not making money off of recording music anymore. You know, the streaming services, they screw them, you know, and they found different ways to license, but they make all of their money on touring. And back in the 70s and 80s, it was the opposite.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, again, Pet Shop Boys need to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I don't care if you, it's dance music, it's if you're putting in rap music, and you're leaving out some great rap bands too, but then you've got to go with the Pet Shop Boys have to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Now, I don't know. They're a fickle group, evidently. There's really no rhyme or reason to how people vote. It's not really structured. You actually have other people lobbying for bands. Like Tom Morello lobbied hard for Kiss.
There were a bunch of people that did the same thing.
Yeah. And again, so I don't care what anybody says. The Pet Shop Boys need to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame before a lot of these bands that are already in.
Because they're still paying their dues. Here's the dilemma that I think that you run into with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is I think to a certain extent they're trying to stay relevant. And I think that's why they fast, not that they fast track, but bands like, you know, the Foo Fighters and Jay-Z, they want, you know, people that are regarded as kind of current bands because they want to pull in, you know, the younger fans. You know, I don't disagree with you that the Pet Shop Boys, you know, probably should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But in terms of bringing new listeners to, you know, Rolling Stone magazine or new readers to Rolling Stone magazine, or, you know, people coming to Cleveland to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum, because, by the way, this is what this is really all about. You know, this is a capitalist monetary thing. This is a way for people to kind of not so much the bands, but, you know, this is a business endeavor.
Then they've lost their way, because every Hall of Fame is about history. It's about paying homage to bands that did their time and have earned it and have broken, you know, like the Go-Go's, you know, they broke the glass ceiling with hitting number one, right? And I guess one of the criteria is doing something that nobody else has done, right? But to start inducting current artists, I think they started with Pearl Jam and Nirvana, and I think U2 was probably when they got voted in, I think U2 was probably the newest band ever to go into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because they were still active. It's like putting Tom Brady in the Football Hall of Fame while he's still playing.
He should be.
This is why normal Hall of Fames have a waiting period, you know? So they're backlogged. Well, you know what? Then every year, just do a dump. Like, you know, just give 15 bands. Make the place bigger.
But do they run into an issue? If they start doing the big dumps...
That's a weird phrase.
But if they start inducting 15 or 20 people, you know, at a time, do they get to a point where all of a sudden they're really kind of scraping to get, you know, look, this may be a byproduct of our age, but when you start getting into, you know, the music bands of the, you know, the 2000s, and certainly, you know, 2010s and the 2020s, are there bands that are current right now? Oh, and let me ask you this. Is rock dead? Are there current bands right now that are out making music that you foresee going into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yes.
They're already in.
That aren't in? No.
No, you said yes. I said yes.
I misunderstood the question.
No, you understood the question. I made a terrible joke. You said yes. I said they're already in.
Oh, see, that was a terrible joke because I didn't get it. Jesus. All right. Are you trying to lower my low? Are you trying to get below my low of 9 to 5?
Oh, if I haven't, I will.
So one of our viewers, Todd Sacco, your arch nemesis.
He's not my arch nemesis.
I know. Todd's a good dude. He said, don't get started with the Go-Go's. But Todd, you arrived to the show a little late. I've been bashing and Jack has been gloating. So there you go.
I know Todd really appreciates good guitar playing. Todd, look it.
All right. Let's not let Todd sidetrack the show, okay? He's a hijacker. He's a great guy, but he's a hijacker. So, you know, so if you want to talk about, you know, you just said it, is rock dead? And I don't think.
But wait a minute. You got to answer the question. Are there current bands right now that you foresee going into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? You said yes.
Yes. And you want to know who they are?
I would like to know who they are.
I think Tool should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, but wait a minute. Tool's not a new band.
I'm talking about. All right. I'm missing your question. New bands? No,
No.
So what I'm saying is if you think about the decade between 2010 to 2020, and now we're only into the beginning of this decade, right? 2021. Do you see any band in the past 15 years? And Tool has been around a lot longer than that.
I mean, you know, if you look
again, this may be a byproduct of our age.
Well, there's no real rock bands out there.
Maybe Mumford and Sons are going to get in.
Who?
Mumford and Sons.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, the Coors might as well go in too, right? Rock is not what it used to be, all right? So listenership since the late 2000s hasn't seen any resurgence in rock, right? In 2017, a study conducted by Nielsen in the U.S. concluded that hip-hop and R&B overtook rock as the most consumed genre for the first time ever. So that's not a good sign for rock. That puts them number three when they were the perennial number ones, right?
Yeah.
It's because no one's creating any new music that's gaining any traction. Like, there's nothing that's like when Nirvana broke, that was a whole different sound. You jump from Loverboy to Nirvana, right? And it was amazing to hear that. You're like, whoa, who's this? Right? It was raw. There's no one out there that's doing that. So who's the latest band that I can think of that got? You got the Killers. The Killers are out there, right?
The Killers have been around for years. When did their first album come out?
14 years ago or so?
I think well beyond before that. I don't know. I'd have to look.
So what about Greta Van Fleet? Didn't they get a little push for a minute?
Yeah. Now, Greta Van Fleet is a good example of a new band that has – I'm not saying that they're Rock and Roll Hall of Fame potential, but they are making a career at playing rock music. We play our own instruments. We don't necessarily use auto-tune. We're not – four guys standing up here behind laptops. We're not a DJ. We're not lip syncing.
I gotcha. Yeah.
You know, this is a real guttural, play our own music. You know, the two bands that jump out at me are Greta Van Fleet, the Struts, I think are a good, you know, rock band right now. I think part of the problem is right now, you know, you made the example of you went from Loverboy to Nirvana. But MTV was still kind of in its heyday, you know, to a certain extent. They were being played on terrestrial radio. And now I think that there are so many different platforms. There's so much choice that, you know, I don't think people know where to find some of this stuff. I think, you know, it's like walking down the cereal aisle. You can get a little bit overwhelmed. There isn't a central focus driving that type of music anymore.
It's like, you know what? It can be related to podcasting. Podcasting.
I would never lower myself to do a podcast.
You're such an asshole. The you know, the magic question with podcasting is how do you take off? How does it catch on? How do you catch on? You know, this is the golden question. How do I get more listeners to my podcast? How do we get more listeners to our podcast? However it's worded, right? So I guess rock music is kind of stuck in there, but pop music isn't. Rap music isn't. R&B music isn't. They seem to be flourishing. So in the mid-80s, rock was firmly established as the number one genre, right? It wasn't until the early in mid-90s that rock made what I call its final step up to this point in advancement. They took it to the next level starting in the 90s, early 90s, all the way through. Because you can't – now, this is just from the 90s, right? And then there's really nothing after this. So you have – I'll name off some groups. Oasis, Pantera, Anthrax, Rage Against the Machine, Korn, Deftones, Tool, Foo Fighters, Bush, Stone Temple Pilots, Weezer, Sonic Youth, Jane's Addiction, Red Hot Chili Peppers, The Black Crowes, Green Day, Soundgarden, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, Nine Inch Nails, Smashing Pumpkins, Radiohead, Garbage, Live, Dave Matthews, White Zombie, Marilyn Manson. I could go on. The 90s exploded with music, and there was no problem finding it. None of this. Rock was not hard to find in the 90s. Yeah. Then you jump into the early 2000s, mid-2000s, and it starts on this little decline, right? Because you can't really see another explosion like that. And these bands, just they ruled the world of music for a decade. And into, they carried over, of course, into they're still around today. Like I said, Korn, I'm going to see them in August. They're still touring. They're still rolling out there, putting out great music. But they're a 90s band. Yeah. Why aren't I going to see a band from, 2010? Because
you could.
They didn't get my attention.
You can. They're out there. You know, right. I mean, Sigur Rós, Vampire Weekend, the Black Keys. Cage the Elephant.
Black Keys. My brother mentioned the Black Keys. And so I think what I'm saying is, and you can name a couple more, but you have to think about it, right? And if we have to think about it, that means there's something wrong. And you and I are, we're above average music listeners. We actually seek out music. We're not afraid to listen. Like, I'm not afraid to listen anything from, the BPM channel on Sirius to, the trucker music, country and Western. I listen to everything, but I don't hear anything that catches my attention.
Well, I think I will self-reflect and self-assess to a certain extent. I think that is a byproduct of a couple of things. Number one, I think that part of it is our age. I don't, even you and I being, and nobody's ever used that term about you and I ever before, above average anything. But we definitely listen to a lot more music than most people.
I think back in the day when we were growing up, you and I were ahead of the curve.
Yeah, those two guys are above average if you look at the scale of who might end up in prison. Well,
no one. I mean, it would be like, damn, they know a lot about fucking music.
They know too much about music. But I do think that there's good rock music out there. To your point, I think that you have to look at it. I think part of it is our age. I think that we probably could do a little bit better job in terms of seeking out new stuff. And that's us. I mean, we go out and we look for new music. There are plenty of people that we know that are still listening to Sweet Home Alabama and, Led Zeppelin and all that stuff. And all that stuff is great, but they've never moved beyond it. Well, you and I have a friend who won't be named that is regarded as a music guy that doesn't know shit about music outside of in 1988.
Right.
Here's the other thing. So I think it's a byproduct of age. I think the other thing is that the machine is not behind rock music anymore.
Because
hip hop gained in popularity. Pop music was always popular and probably always will be popular because it's so easily accessible. And then the rise of country music. Think about it. When we grow up, how many country stations were there around? Even in the 90s.
Again, that's just pop music with cowboy hats. That is not me. That I will be old school. I'll be firm on that. I liked it when it used to be called country western.
Yeah.
Right?
I think it went to
old country, and now it's just Garth Brooks was the devil. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Nah.
I think there may be one other element to that is how many young kids do you see playing guitar these days? And I don't mean, playing an acoustic or anything like that, but kids getting in a garage together and just banging it out and trying to find something. I mean, a lot of the great, great bands of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, were garage bands that really loved that music and wanted to play. Kids don't necessarily socialize like that anymore.
In America,
it doesn't exist. I'm just wondering if it's a lot less than it used to be.
I think in America, it still exists. It's still there. It's still. I mean, I read a Facebook post from a friend of mine, a friend of ours, who's a heavy metal guitarist. I've seen his videos. I've seen him play. The guy can wail on the guitar, but he never really got anywhere with it, and he's frustrated, you know, guitar player with great ideas and great songs, which, again, that's the question: how do I get my music out there, right? And so I don't know. I didn't know many guitar players growing up, so I can't answer that question on how many kids today are playing guitars. But I do know, as far as garage bands go and stuff like that, we talked about this on our Irish Music in America podcast on St. Patrick's Day, that over in Ireland, there's a huge movement of garage band music.
Well, wouldn't it be great to see a big resurgence of...
I'm waiting for it. But I don't know if America will take it. I don't know if they'll... You know, that's where, like I said, the Murder Capital, that's the latest album I bought from that group in Ireland. And they're a bunch of kids that just started in garage bands. You know, they just get out there and they tear it up. And then they improve and then they get better. But there's a big resurgence of that over in Ireland, but not here. It's not the cool thing to do now. The cool thing is to just, and we have kids. We watched our kids grow up. And, you know, I see kids today, you know, and all they want to do is, I don't know, wear their pants down there halfway down their ass and, you know, and walk like a slouch and, you know, and they listen to hip hop. And I love hip hop. I've been listening to hip hop from the beginning. I've been listening to it since probably 19. I think the first time I started listening to hip hop was probably 1980, 82. I think,
yeah, you know,
never stopped listening.
Is it, you know, part of it that the technology has come around? Like, so kids that may in the past, you know, maybe they would have actually picked up a guitar or a set of drums or whatnot, but instead kids are making beats with their laptop.
So that's a whole nother thing. These bands that they had, like, you know, you could say like Limp Bizkit, okay? They had, you know, they had a DJ. And it was DJ Lethal from the House of Pain, right? So he had Lightning Strike twice. That dude, he was huge. They were huge. The House of Pain in their day, they were one of the biggest, and they're legendary in their own way. And then he jumps in with Limp Bizkit and takes off. So, and you had a lot of bands in the 90s had DJs.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of did that crossover thing because those kids were listening to hip hop. You know, Sublime had a DJ.
Yeah.
Incubus has a DJ.
Linkin
Park has a DJ. Yeah. So you start seeing that. And so was that the turning point? And then, you know, was that the halfway point between rock and hip hop? And then hip hop and R&B and pop music just kind of took it from there and left rock behind. I don't know. You can't really put your finger on it.
I honestly think that it's a combination of all that stuff. And I think part of it is, you know, kind of getting a little bit older and, you know, the musical, you know, styles and taste changes, whatnot. As a matter of fact, you know, Deb and I were watching television tonight after dinner and there was an ad, you know, that came on that was highlighting the Billboard Music Awards, I think, are Sunday night. And I have to tell you, for the first time in forever, you know, let's say that they rattled off 20 names. I didn't know 12 of them, 15 of them. I didn't know
why. Because these bands are big on YouTube and other streaming services that we don't really, you know, jump
but
into.
Why isn't mainstream radio playing the new stuff? Why are they still playing, you know, the Stones from the 70s and the 80s and whatnot? You know, if you go around the dial, terrestrial radio, it's either classic rock going up into, as you said, maybe the late 90s, maybe the early 2000s, right? You got your old classic rock, new pop, hip hop, country. You don't really have like a WFNX anymore that used to promote new music.
Because no one wants to be bold and daring and try to break break
WBCN to a certain extent, especially their Nocturnal Emission show on Sunday night.
K-Rock in
new
LA.
Music.
K-Rock in LA did it. You don't
have that format anymore. You don't have, you know, college radio breaking that type of music anymore.
No. And you won't until some, you know, and again, as far as music goes, my wife and I were, we went to a Vietnamese little like kind of restaurant. It was kind of a cafe, in downtown Boca. And, you know, there's a couple of young girls behind the counter, there's young white girls behind the counter. And it's just basically me and my wife in there. And they got a soundtrack playing, like, it's like a mixtape. Jump from hip hop to classic rock to, you know, like a BPM. And then again, another classic rock. And I'm just sitting, I asked one of the girls, I said, whose playlist is this? This girl can't be 21. She might be 20. She's got kind of like the hoodie on, jeans, you know. And I said, whose playlist is this? She goes, it's mine. I go, you got a pretty good taste of music. You jump around. I said, what do you listen to? What are you listening to? Like, what's good that's new? And her response was, I only listen to basically classic rock and maybe some old hip hop. She goes, I don't really listen to anything new. Yeah. And I was kind of taken aback. And so that ties into one of our viewers, Renee, just messaged in. I would love to see young musicians come back to rock. My kids listen to indie and screamo, but also classic rock. So kids are still listening to classic rock even today. But no new artists are doing rock and roll for that generation. If they are, they're not getting picked up. Record companies don't have the sway and pull that they used to have, right? They used to be the promotional machine. I think a lot of these bands are trying to go indie, and it's not working for them. I'm sure there's a great band out there that we're missing.
I mean, you know, for years and years, the record companies were vilified, and, you know, maybe correctly so. But they served a purpose. You know, they would put energy and resources behind a band and develop them. Now, that got lost along the way, but because you don't have that kind of central, you know, it's almost like, you know, there's so many great TV shows on out there right now that it's hard to keep track of.
Not right now.
What do you mean?
It used to be. I mean, network television is dead.
No, but it's been replaced by, you know, Netflix and Hulu and all of that original content, you know, HBO. You know, there's some amazing.
You have to watch what you watch, and because again, I don't even want to get into that. That could be a whole nother podcast on the death of Hollywood, but in the wokeness and in the preaching that we don't want to hear. And you know what? These rock bands, these kids don't have anything to say.
Yeah.
Rock used to be about what you, now they put it all in rap. They rap it instead of sing it.
I don't know that I agree with that. I think that there's probably,
you better agree.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of musicians. I think there's probably plenty of people playing rock, but it's so spread out and there's no kind of direct forum or no record companies or MTV that is actually pushing that it leaves it for us to go out and find. And sometimes there are so many outlets that it's kind of hard to find. You know, there's some great stuff. I'll tell you, my daughter turns me on to a lot of, you know, new music and whatnot. And some of I like and some of it I don't. But I think some of it is on us. But it'll be interesting to see if it actually makes some.
I don't know. I do a lot of searching, man. I search around on Amazon. I search around on Spotify. I search around on YouTube. I do it more than probably the average person, looking for something to grab my attention. That's how I found that group, the Murder Capital. I was just searching around, and I found them, and I think they're pretty good, right?
Yeah.
So, again, maybe they'll break through. Someday, hopefully soon, some kid is going to pick up his father's or his grandfather's old, you know, Fender Strat and start playing something that means something. So they're going to break through that glass ceiling and bring it back. Somebody's going to do that. It can't die. It won't die on the vine.
No, I don't think it'll ever. I don't think it'll ever die. But I'll tell you what. Between now and the next time that we get together, I challenge you to find five bands, one song a piece. That you know, we don't have to spend a show talking about it.
I got you.
Just something that you and I can throw out there and maybe have people listen to and you and I can listen to. Look at how excited you are about this.
Well, didn't we just do an episode on music you might have missed?
Yeah, but that went back, you know, a bit. So bands that have come out in the past, anytime in the past.
I don't want to dedicate a show to it. We'll do a segment.
No. We don't have to dedicate a show to it.
Yeah. We could do it at the end. We'll dedicate you know what you don't hear anymore? Either that used to be a big part of music, live albums.
Yeah.
You don't hear live albums used to be a special occasion, right?
Live albums.
Everybody had to do a live album. Everybody, every group had to do a live album.
All right. What's your favorite live album? What's your top five live albums of all time?
My personal. Number one, and I think I wore out the grooves on this double record set, was David Bowie's album, David Live at the Tower in Philadelphia. Came out in 74. Now, that was his transition from Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, Diamond Dogs into the Young Americans, his blue-eyed soul, or as some people called it, Plastic Soul. And it was called Plastic Soul because there was a lot of people that didn't think that he had the authenticity. It lacked the authenticity of soul music. But I will say Young Americans is, it could arguably be my favorite record ever of any record I've ever heard. I love that album, Young Americans. It is such a great, great album that people don't go back and listen to. They all want to listen to Ziggy Stardust. They all want to listen to, you know, a Diamond Dogs. So that would be number one. I listened to that. And the quality of the album was horrible. I just didn't realize it until I went back and listened to it as I got older. And they remastered it, I think, twice. The quality was not good, right? But I loved it. I didn't know any better when I was a kid. So the second one was another album that I wore out, the Jimi Hendrix Otis Redding Experience from the Monterey Pop Festival in 67. Jimi Hendrix live on one side, Otis Redding live on the other.
I love that record. All right, so Randy, on the count of three, which side did you like better, Hendrix or Otis? Ready? One, two, three. Otis Redding.
Hendrix.
No,
I loved his version of Like a Rolling Stone.
Huh?
And Wild Thing. I loved his version of Wild Thing. I loved his version of Like a Rolling Stone. It was a great album.
Satisfaction. Otis Redding, Satisfaction, or Try a Little Tenderness. I love that record.
There you go. So there you go.
Believe it or not, I don't have that record anymore. I need to get a copy of it.
I do too, believe it or not. I don't have it either. I don't think I have it.
I don't think it's that difficult to find. It's not that expensive either.
No, but once again, that shows how you and I, that album pretty much defines
our musical. That record.
So
love that record. And what a weird album. You know, a live record with you know, two separate bands on one.
I thought that was kind of odd too, but it was brilliant promotion because, you know, you're going to get both fans buying the album. So it was a great move, right? Lynyrd Skynyrd, One More for the Road, was one of my favorite live albums. It was recorded over three nights in 76 at the Fox Theater in Atlanta, Georgia. I guess they were friends with the promoter, Alex Cooley. He ran that theater forever, and they kind of kept him alive. They continuously played there. They were friends with them. So that was actually
beautiful first theater.
Yeah. You know, that's the infamous play it pretty for Atlanta, right? Which Freebird is a better song than Stairway to Heaven. Let's pick that one back up. But that was their first and only live album with the original lineup. After that, the plane crashed, and that was it.
They were a great, great band.
Yeah, they were. Now, this one's kind of a toss-up, but they were big albums when we were growing up. Bob Seger, Live Bullet. an amazing, amazing, amazing version of Traveling Man, Beautiful Loser. What a transition. Probably, I don't know of any other songs that I ever heard that transitioned into another song so seamlessly, so perfectly. And it gives you goosebumps when you go back and you listen to it. It gives me goosebumps. I'm like, that is so fucking perfect. And it's live. It's live. And that's what made it that much more amazing, right? So that's one. And then Nine Tonight. I think you and I, that Nine Tonight was released in 1981, Bob Seger. It's recorded in Detroit, Michigan, and in Boston at the Boston Garden.
Yep.
In October of 1980.
Yep.
I think we were at that show. Now, that show was pretty interesting because he had canceled a show like 6 months prior to that. He had to cancel, and he came back, and I've never seen this before or since. Now, you've been to probably double the concerts I've been to, but I've been to up in the high 80s. In maybe, I don't know, maybe in the 80s concert-wise, my entire life, which is a lot of concerts, but you've been to like 380, so.
Yeah, I've been a lot.
you collect concerts, my friend.
I've been a lot.
That show, I think he played two songs, and the crowd was just so fired up to see him. I think I was sitting in like 20th row on the floor. Ticket was like $12. He after the second song, he just stopped and he said, listen, everybody, you need to sit down and take it easy because this is going to be a long night.
Yep.
Right?
He played a long time.
He gave us forewarning and everybody sits down and he starts playing and everybody stands up again. Right? So I think he probably played for 2 hours that night,
yeah.
If I remembered correctly. So that's one of my favorite live albums. And I think Alto Ray, his saxophonist, right?
Alto Reed.
When he when they did Turn the Page, he popped up over in the Loge section to the right of the stage and the spotlight was on him.
Nope. What? It was Main Street.
That was Main Street? Okay. That's either way. I know I remember seeing him. I was shit faced. And I was 15. I don't know.
You know why I remember that?
Why?
He was right in front of me.
See, I had better seats than you, but he was right in front of you. So screw you again.
Yeah, I got to see Alto Reed's ass.
Ah, there you go. Okay. And I think my final favorite live album is an underrated live album. Alice in Chains Unplugged from 1996.
That's a good one.
I think that is better than Nirvana's Unplugged. I really, really do. I think it was, and that record got shit on when it first came out. People were like, oh, they're not an acoustic band. They can't play acoustics like that. You know, it's not for them. But then, you know, as time goes on, all these, you know, critics that slammed it end up kissing its ass after Layne Staley dies and everyone praises it up. Oh, it's such a great album. You know, that's why critics suck. But Alice in Chains Unplugged, I'm pretty sure most people have heard it. If you haven't, go on MTV. You can watch it. Layne Staley was in his, you know, wearing his gloves mode from hiding the track marks. And that was pretty much one of the last shows they ever did with him.
Yeah.
And he died in 2002. A very underrated frontman.
Very sad story.
Yeah. Yeah, great voice, haunting.
Very, very sad story. All right, so I'll give you mine. And just for the record, I love live albums. This is yet again another area where, like, Deb and I are on opposite ends of the spectrum. She doesn't get it. Like, I would much rather listen to a live album than a lot of studio records. And she just doesn't have an appreciation for it. She likes the production and the clarity that actually comes with a studio album. But, you know, off the top of my head, because I haven't really prepared a list, and I'm actually kind of looking behind me, I think, you know, my favorites are probably The Who, Live at Leeds, is a monster, you know, record. Just a band in their prime Gritty, edgy, not great production, but just they were ferocious.
Angry. They were very angry.
And very angry. But, you know, plus, you know, one of the cool things about live records, especially back in the 70s and 80s, is they were always kind of packaged in a fun way. They were a double, you know, they had a gatefold. They always came with a poster, or they like the Who's, you know, situation. It actually came with replicas of all of the artifacts from that show, you know, the bills, the way that the stage was put together and all that stuff. But that record is something that I still listen to from start to finish. I mean, it's just a testament and a document of that band in its absolute prime. One that's a little bit different, and I know that we've bring him up from time to time, and he's probably one of you know, more of a favorite of mine than yours or a lot of people that are probably listening to. But there's a Joe Jackson album. That's a double record. What's that?
That's your man.
Yeah. Like, you know, 1980 to, you know, 1990 or something like that. But it has different cuts from different shows and different eras. And it's just a great way to kind of travel through his career and the different bands that he played with. But he's a guy that can just play, and he can still hit the high notes. He can still really sing. He's always had a killer, killer band. So, you know, that's something that I still listen to today. This one may be a little bit controversial because it's technically, I guess, a soundtrack. But the band, The Last Waltz, is something that I used to play as a kid that I still play today, you know, quite often. You know, so, you know, again, when the band decided that they were actually going to call it quits, and supposedly, at least according to Robbie Robertson, he didn't want the band to quit altogether. He just wanted to be off the road. But they never made another record together, the entire band. But, you know, if you look at that, The Last Waltz, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Paul Butterfield, Eric Clapton, Ronnie Hawkins, Neil Young. I mean, that record is just fantastic. And one of the things that I really admire about that band is they invited all of those people. They didn't really know how to play all of those people's songs at the time. They really had to almost wing it. And it just goes to show you how accomplished they were. And even the Muddy Waters song that's on there is just makes the hair on my arm stand up. It's just a record that, again, I played when I first saw the documentary on Star Channel when cable first came out.
I remember that. Yep.
And I still play it pretty often. So another one that might be a little bit difficult to kind of put your hands on. But again, one of the things that I really appreciate about this band is Pearl Jam actually records everything that they do live. Now, they don't necessarily put out live albums. They do occasionally. But on their fan site, you can go right now and you can get pretty much any Pearl Jam live show for the past 30 years. And there was a show that took place at the Boston Garden, the new Boston Gardens in 2010. That is just unbelievable. You know, again, you know, a band that was just one of those magical nights that they just had their shit together and just played, you know, unbelievable. Another one that I love is the Queen live album from Wembley. So the 86 tour. So after they had the big triumphant night at Live Aid, they realized that they had a lot to offer, and they went on a huge stadium tour around the world, with the exception of America. They didn't come to America, but that record is just, that band was just incredibly tight. And Freddie Mercury was just a hell of a showman. So it really gave you a sense of what it was like to see them live. Was that five?
That's five. I got the bonus one. You know about this. I forget what year, you'll know. When did we see The Alarm at the Orpheum Theater?
It was 83, 84.
A couple years ago on Record Store Day, they released The Alarm live at the Orpheum Theater. That was the show that you and I went to, where we met the band. They got off the bus in the wrong place. They were walking around like lost puppies.
Yeah, they signed my paycheck that I never got to cash.
I couldn't believe that was the album of all albums that got released. That's one of my favorite concert stories, because it was so random to see the bus stop at the top of that street that the Orpheum was on and see them come wandering down Yeah. It was like they were no older than us. They weren't that much older than us.
Yeah. So I'll tell you, speaking of the Orphan, when you're talking about live records, how many bands actually recorded live albums at the Orpheum? There's a ton. So, you know, Under a Blood Red Sky, U2, they recorded the majority of that at Red Rocks, but there's a cut or two from the Orpheum. The Allman Brothers recorded an album there. The Alarm recorded an album there. There's a video of Keith Richards and the Expensive Winos from the Orpheum. There's, if you go and look, there's got to be 20 or 30 live albums from the Orpheum Theater because the acoustics are so good in that building.
What a great place to see shows. We were so lucky growing up, man.
Yeah. Amazing place. Here's another live album that was recorded. There was The Police. There's a live album from the Orpheum that was originally broadcast on WBCN. So, you know, while we're talking about live albums, what about the biggies? What about the famous ones? You know, the legendary.
Don't say Kiss Alive. Don't say Kiss Alive.
What about, you know, Kiss Alive and Cheap Trick Live at Budokan? Peter Frampton comes alive.
Oh, all right. So let's stop right there. Peter Frampton Comes Alive has three fucking good songs on it, but they were monster songs. Can anybody else name any song other than those three that you can? But I don't think there's a lot of people out there. If you ask them today, name another song off that album. I mean, it was a good album. That was actually the first double live album. That was the first album to go, gold cassette gold. Instead of a gold record, he got a gold cassette.
So anybody that's listening out there, take up Scott's challenge. Peter Frampton Comes Alive. Look, Do You Feel Like We Do?
One.
Baby, I Love Your Way and Show Two. Me the Way. They're all great songs. Three. But there's songs in there like he does a version of Jumpin' Jack Flash. That's amazing. There's a song called Doobie Wah that's on there. It's a much better record than you think it is beyond the hits that you know.
Oh, it is. But again, that's what made that song so over the top popular. It was a mega, mega live album, but it was a live album for three songs.
You can say the same thing. So Cheap Trick Live at Budokan. So aside from Ain't That a Shame, I Want You to Want Me.
Yeah.
And no, Surrender. Right. What else is on that?
That's a tribute to how great those songs are. You know what I mean? No, so and I'm not knocking Cheap Trick,
but not for Peter Frampton.
I am not knocking Peter Frampton, but he never did really anything after that. And he never really did anything before that either.
He was, you know, he was
a middle-of-the-road rock guy. He was a middle-of-the-road rock.
He was a mid-level star that had a magical night that got caught on tape. And
the cover with him.
I agree with you. He didn't do much after that. You know,
no. He created that machine, though, that wah-wah machine or whatever. He the foot pedal and the he did master that. He made a lot of money off of that thing too. Yeah. He still is.
So you know what? Just to kind of redeem myself from the last time that we got together, Song Remains the Same, Led Zeppelin, terrible live record. Led Zeppelin, A Celebration, when they played at the O2 in 2007 or whenever it was, fucking fantastic record.
Right. Again, I mean, I like Song Remains the Same. That's
ooh.
All right, listen, buddy. We're over an hour. Great show, man. Great show. Hang in there. I'm gonna exit us out. Okay.
One more show.
This is you. Go ahead. Asshole. All right, so this has been Milk Crates and Turntables, a music discussion podcast. You can find us streaming over Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. The podcast itself is on every podcast platform there is, almost, but all the big ones, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify. So if you like this show, give it a listen. If you have suggestions, comments, email us at milkcratesandturntables@gmail.com. That's milkcratesandturntables@gmail.com. Let us know. But in the meantime, if you like the show, pass it on to your friends. Give it a listen. Give it a download. Give it a 5 stars. Give it a comment. Do whatever you want. But thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. And that's it. Jack, hang in there, and I'm going to log us out.
All right.
All right. Rock is not dead. I got to go. I got it.